On the first tape.
Yeah.
The first tape it was. But
that story is on the first tape.
Okay, we're resuming now. We ran out of the first tape. Now this is tape two. And I'm talking with Shirley Rothman and Lillian Levine, and we'll continue talking about the voyage.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I think that we were at the kinds of foods that were offered to us. We were on mostly, since we were on a Holland-American line, and I think we mentioned the name of the ship. If it didn't get on the first tape, we'll repeat that. It was the SS Rindam. I think it spells Rindam. There may be some. Shirley thinks it's another spelling, but it can be checked out. And whichever it is, it is the Rindam pronounced that way. Anyhow, what I started to say was that the food consisted mostly of herring. I guess that's the national food of the Dutch people. So we were fed herring a lot. I don't recall any other food because I was not very interested in eating anyway since I was seasick. Excuse me. But you wanted to know about the voyage. It was very stormy, very severe. The ship was rocking and rolling, and it was really a very, very rough voyage. One time I went upstairs to the lavatory, and I wanted to see what it looked like on the outside, because being downstairs in the steerage, there were no windows, and we really did not know. We might have even been below sea level, for all I know. And so I stood up on the toilet seat. I wanted to see what was going on outside, and I quickly ran down because it was so frightening. There were two huge waves, one on either side of the ship, black water. And I was frightened from that, and I said, my goodness gracious, this is very, very rough and very dangerous. So I quickly left the area and went down to my bed and lay down again.
Well, to emphasize about the scariness of the ship, when I was not as sick as she and my mother and the other children were. I was walking around with my two cousins, Rose and Sylvia, and we went up on the deck. And it was so frightening. Like Lillian said, two black walls, and the ship looked like a speck on the bottom, that any minute we would be absorbed into this ocean. So I ran down, and I was scared, and I never went up on deck again until we reached New York Harbor. But as far as the food is concerned, we were being cheated all the time. They ripped us off wherever, as soon as we started, as soon as we came to Warsaw, they started ripping us off from all directions. My mother was told that each and every one of us had glaucoma. We had to be treated for glaucoma, which was no such thing. We were healthy children, and she was healthy. We were told we had all kinds of diseases that we had to be treated for. And the same cheating went on for as long as we were in Warsaw, until my mother finally got all her papers and we were able to leave. We had to travel to Rotterdam, or through a good portion of Europe. We went through Germany until we got to Rotterdam. And we finally, when we did get on the ship and we were supposed to get certain kinds of food, all we got was herring, and they stole the rest of it and put it away, and they were selling it. The stewards were selling it. So my two cousins, Rose and Sylvia, and a friend of theirs, a young man, we decided that we're not going to let them get away with it. We're going to get some of that food. So they picked me up and lowered me into this open-top closet. And I picked up all the goodies that we were supposed to get, such as jelly and oranges and cookies and whatever. And I handed it out to them, and we got it back. And this is how we got some of the food that we were supposed to get.
What happened in Warsaw? In other words, somebody wanted to convince your mother to pay them to treat you.
Right, that's right. They invented all kinds of diseases for us. First of all, we didn't we couldn't afford to stay at a hotel, so they had these like bed and breakfast places that we have here. We slept on the floor for as long as we were in Warsaw, which I think was about 10 days. I don't know how long we were there. We had no beds. They laid out these people who rented their homes to the immigrants. They laid out mattresses on the floor, and we slept on them. I don't know how much my mother had to pay for that accommodation, but this is how we stayed. And every time my mother went to a doctor, we had to get papers, certificates for the eyes and ears and whatever else. She was told that we had all kinds of diseases and we'd have to be treated for it, which wasn't.
Did she believe it?
She did not, and she didn't follow through. And we started out for the port, and that's how we got there. And it was not necessary. We were fine. We were wonderful. But everybody tried to make money on the immigrants that were going to America.
I just want to mention about Warsaw, this place that we finally landed, where Shirley said we slept on the floors, and there were some people that slept in beds. They must have had more money, or they came before us, and they wouldn't relinquish the beds. So we stayed on the floor. My cousin Rose thought this place was so awful that she made up a song, and she called this place the Hotel Nassen. She says, "In Hotel Nassen sind immer ungekommen, ja, ja, ungekommen." She made this up, and to this day I remember it.
Could you say, is that the whole song?
May have been more, but this is all I can remember.
And what does it say?
It's
Yiddish. It says, "In Hotel Nassen." Nassen means give me, give me. We came to this place. Ja, ja, ungekommen. Yes, yes, we came to this place. Uh-huh. Rose had a wonderful imagination. She was a
woman with an imagination, and she was inventive, and she should have been something other than what she did in her lifetime. Her wish and her hope was to be an actress. But that was not what she was, and was never encouraged into it. Her parents, certainly her father, discouraged her greatly. And it was, in those days, it might have been a lot easier to get into the movies or the theater, because the competition wasn't as great as is it now. And in New York was the hub of this type of work. But she was always really... how shall I say? She was being made fun of.
Ridiculed.
She was ridiculed because she wanted to be in the theater, and that's where she should have been.
Can you remember any other instances of being cheated as immigrants?
Yes.
Not really, because if there was more cheating, perhaps the older people would have remembered, but I don't remember that. I do remember one thing, however, on the trip. It was a very long trip to Rotterdam from where we started in Ostrov. Many, many weeks, I think it must have been. And we slept on in all the stations, waiting for trains for hours, in depots, and once in a while, my mother and my aunt, too, she was traveling with us, my Aunt Esther, she with her children, my cousins, they would buy something for the children. And once they bought a coconut cream pie with a lot of soft stuff in the middle. And they bought this pie for us, for the children. There were so many of us, Kenan Hora. David, not knowing that the pie was on a chair, he sat right down on that pie, and everybody was licking his behind. And that's true.
Yeah.
David was one of those, shall I say, temperamental artists? No, not quite. He was a
clown. He really was a comedian.
He was a clown,
yeah.
Yes, even in those days.
Yeah.
But particularly later, he was a clown. He had such crazy novel ideas, which we went along with. Everything David said, we did. And so this particular time, it was one of those places where we had to wait for a train for many hours. And I was sleeping, and I got up to find out that that's what happened. I couldn't believe that we lost that pie in such a terrible way.
Do you know how it was decided that your Aunt Esther and your cousins would leave at the same time you did?
Well, yes, because my Aunt Esther depended on my mother a great deal. She loved her dealer. She was her sister-in-law. They were sisters-in-law. But somehow, in this country, the connotation sister-in-law or mother-in-law has a very funny meaning. You know, something isn't right. You know, your mother-in-law, you know, mm-hmm. quotation. But they were sisters-in-law, but they were really very loving, and they loved each other, and they were like sisters. And my Aunt Esther depended a great deal on my mother because my mother was, I don't know, she was able to do things. Yeah, she had a lot of, she was very aggressive, and independent. And she was an independent woman. She was able to do things. My Aunt Esther was not able to do anything. She couldn't accomplish too much. She was sort of a sickly woman.
Well, now, did her husband send money?
Yes,
at
he
the
did.
Same time.
Yes, so he did. He sent money at the same time. So they made arrangements to travel together, because they loved each other and they wanted to, and we all loved each other and we wanted to travel together, and that's what we did, and. And my mother got all the papers for everybody. She got all the visas. She got all the accommodations.
Okay, we're stopping here for telephone. Okay, we're resuming again after telephone call.
Yes, and I just, Shirley was talking about our trip with our cousins, with our beloved Aunt Esther. Aunt Esther was a wonderful person. This is truly from the heart. She loved people. We loved her. She understood everything, and she was such a kind woman. She was a wonderful mother. Madeline, each time she talks about her mother to this day, there are tears in her eyes. And we really felt very close to her, as well as we did to the rest of the family. Now, talking about David, Nat wants me to tell the story. When we were very small, and David was very small himself, we had a death of a bird.
Oh, God.
In our court, a little bird died, and David said, "Let's make a funeral, and let's have a burial." He carried the bird somehow in a box, and we all marched together behind him, and he dug a little hole someplace near his house.
Yeah.
And we all cried about the bird, and we buried the bird, and we thought it was a very honorable way of disposing of the body. One day, David says, "You know, I wonder what happened to the bird in there." So we dug the bird up, and we were shocked to see the cavity filled with worms. And that's the last time we'll ever do that again.
And I want to tell you what effect that this thing had on me. That years and years later, when I was married and my husband and I went to an affair and his family, and they served, what's that chicken from?
With wild rice.
Yeah, Cornish hen with wild rice. I cut open the little Cornish hen, and I saw the wild rice, and I never could eat it because it reminded me of the worms and the cavity of that bird.
And strangely enough, David, who was our cousin, he and we were doing things together, whereas I don't recall that he ever did this with his own sisters and brother.
No.
Just with us.
Yeah.
So we really miss David a great deal for many, many reasons.
Okay, let's see, Ellis Island. How long did you have to stay there?
I reckon, I sound like a Westerner, I think that it was no less than 12 days due to all that reason for my father being sick in the hospital, had still not been discharged, and then we had to get a bond. And it took a long time to get a bond. Finally, there was this bond, and we were released. but the experience in Ellis Island, I think we had that on the first tape, was the most unpleasant. We bore it all. We had to stand and wait for a cot or some sort of sleeping arrangement, which were just the coil springs, nothing else. There were no mattresses on the beds. And Shirley and I had to, we knew they would open the doors at a certain hour. We wanted to be first to get the beds. So we stood in front of that door, and people piled up behind us. And before they, when they would open the doors finally, there was so much pushing and so much shoving, and we ran, being small and children, we were able to run fast, and we were able to get a couple of, she lay on one, I lay on the other, and the other, when the rest of the family came, my mother and the small children, we shared those two coil match springs as beds, and this went on for the length of time that we were there. So Ellis Island is not a pleasant place to look back on. However, it was a wonderful sight when we finally came to it and saw the Statue of Liberty, and we felt that the journey was over and we would finally land, have our feet on the ground. So Ellis Island, though not a pleasant experience, it is a life experience and something that we had to live. And I don't know whether, Shirley, you want to say anything about Ellis Island?
Well, nothing. I think you've covered it pretty well, except this, unless Janet wants us to repeat the story about Mama and that woman from where they had the incident about the seat. We had no seats. We were in a big room in Ellis Island. There were a lot of people, all the people who had to be there. In one big room, we didn't have a place where to sit. We sat on the floor, or there was a bench without a back. But there were some seats near the windows facing the ocean that were occupied by other people, and so we didn't have any. But one woman got up, and she must have gone to the bathroom. So my mother noticed that there's a seat near the window. She went over to sit down and rest her back a little bit for a while. When that woman came back, she said to her, "Get out of that seat. That's my seat." She was it was a different language.
She
was an Italian woman from she was a Sicilian, I think. And she said to her, you know, to get out of the seat. My mother understood what she meant, but she said, "I'm sitting here now." Well, if my mother didn't get up quickly enough, she pulled out a knife and was going to stab her unless she relinquished that seat. So that was one of the things that we had to live through. And I remember when we came to Ellis Island before we left for America, my mother made me a very beautiful coat. I should come in looking like a somebody. She made me, it was like a military blue double-breasted coat, which some seamstress made up for me. And Lillian and I had dresses alike, red plaid dresses, and I had that dress and the coat to wear over it. Well, while we were there in that room, I didn't have to wear a coat, so I must have left it lying somewhere. And before I knew it, somebody had stolen it. And it just broke my heart. This brand new coat that I was so proud of, that my mother had made for me, was stolen. And so, of course, I don't remember too much about the food in Ellis Island. The only thing I remember is the first time I ate breakfast, they served me cornflakes with hot milk. And the cornflakes melted into the milk, and it was like brown mud, and I couldn't eat it. But otherwise, I don't remember any of the food that we had there. Do you?
I remember only the first night where we had the hamburgers. And there were two dining rooms. One was for kosher, and one was not kosher. But being greenhorns, we didn't know which was which, and we went into the one that was non-kosher. And we were served hamburgers, and not knowing that it wasn't kosher, everybody was eating. But since I myself was not feeling well, I wasn't eating anything. And the man next to me on my left was really looking at that longingly at my hamburger, which wasn't being eaten. I asked him whether he wanted the hamburger, and he said yes, so I gave it to him. But later, when I found out that this was not a kosher dining room, I was so happy that I had not eaten an unkosher hamburger.
How did you feel? Were you? What did you do during the days? All those long days.
Yeah, those are the days that we did very little. First of all, we were not allowed out. I think we were locked in, but they did have the very large doors. I can recall only one time they opened up those doors to the water. We could see it was like a loading platform, I think, because you could walk out on the loading platform, but not any further. And we could get some air from there, but just the one day, I'm sure there was never another day. But what we did, nothing. The only time that we did do something was the day that I became eligible to go up to the playroom. They did have a playroom for children. And how I became eligible, I don't know, but I did become eligible, and I went up there to play. They had a game room, they had dolls, and they had other toys with which to play. And the person who was there in charge gave me a little flannel dress. This little dress became my joy, my delight. I had never had a short dress. This was a dress way above my knees, and I loved it. Up to that point, everything was below my knees and very long, because it had to be handed down to the next person, the next child. This little dress, I don't know what happened to it to this. Of course, it's many years since, but I wish that I had been able to keep it and hold on to it for memory. That I think it must have been given away eventually, because when we moved to Henry Street, I never had it anymore. So my aunt, that's another thing. When we came to this country, there was a belief that everything we came with had to be thrown away, and everybody had to get citrus magnesia. And I had to drink citrus magnesia. It was horrible. But that's what they thought needed to be done with people who came as immigrants. I don't know where that came from, but we had to do it. I remember drinking that milk, not milk, citrus magnesia. It is awful.
It was the idea of simply
cleansing us.
And clothes, too. They had to give everything away. They gave away my other things, all my other things. I didn't have too much, but whatever we came with, I don't know what happened to it, so they must have given it away. And that little dress, they didn't know that was an American dress, or I would have been able to keep it. They thought I brought it probably from Poland, and they gave that away, too, I guess. I can only guess, because I really don't know what happened. Nothing was left. So that's it. I mean, but Ellis Island, that's one good memory I have of Ellis Island, that playroom with this lady who was in charge. As I said on the first tape, I think she was from the Red Cross, although I'm not sure if they operated out of the Ellis Island at that time.
Social workers.
But that's the one good thing that I remember about Ellis Island, like having to go up there for the afternoon and play. It was pleasant then, but that's all. The other things that stand out very much in my mind are those waiting for those cots,
We really didn't have much to do in Ellis Island. It was a very boring time. We just sat around. There was nothing. They didn't do very much for the people who were sitting there all day long.
Well, the thing is, I don't think people spent as much time as we did. They came and they went. That's the reason why they didn't have much for anything for anyone to do. They didn't realize that there were four children there for 12 days, and we had nothing to do there. They should have certainly had a teacher or somebody. But that was 1921, and I guess things were different in those days.
Can you say any more about the difference in clothing from what you were used to in Poland and then when you got to the United States and what you wore?
I can remember some things. In Europe, we had very little clothing. When it was very cold, we had no coats. We used to call what we wore, we used to call it a derale. It was a sort of a balbriggan shawl. It was supposed to be warm, but how warm can it be when it's very cold weather?
It was like a woolen stole. That's what it really was.
That's all we had.
Yeah.
And we also had some kind of very warm shoes, the volakis.
Yeah.
I didn't have them. Some people had them.
Did I have them?
David had them.
Yeah, I think I had
David
them.
David had all kinds of sores on his feet when we came to we were traveling.
Yeah.
From the cold, frostbitten. It was very cold where we were. It was on the Russian, very close to the Russian border. It was very cold where we were. But however, even with the little derala which we wore, I went to school that way. And the day that I described on the first tape, where I went to school and there was such high snow and it was so very cold, but I wouldn't miss school. We got there. When I got there, the school was not open. It was closed, and I had to come back. It was quite a trip to go to the school. It wasn't around the corner. It was a long distance. For me, it seemed like a long distance. And I came back, and my hands were so frostbitten. I remember crying and feeling so much pain because I was so cold, and my hands were all frostbitten from the pain. I guess this is why I was crying. I do remember the clothing. The clothing that I had there, as I said before, if I had a dress, it was down to my ankles maybe. When I came here and they gave me that little dress, I loved it so. So the clothing was different. Here we didn't even have sweaters. We had no coats, no sweaters, no nothing. I don't know if other children had it, but we didn't. And
I remember our father sent me a sweater. It must have been from Morris's factory. His cousin Morris Bloom had a knitting factory. He made all kinds of knitted things. Later on in life, after I was married and had a child, I remember going to his factory, and he gave me some suits, you know, knitted suits, like a two-piece dress or whatever. But I remember my father sent me a blue sweater, which I wore in the winter. It was a little thin sweater. It was something that I would wear here, like the top over my shoulders. But I wore it during the winter time for warmth, going to school. I don't remember any clothing that we had. I just don't remember.
Do you remember shoes?
I was going to say about the shoes. In the summertime, we wore no shoes. Barefoot. Everything was barefoot. And if I don't remember having shoes. I think once or twice my mother did get us shoes for Passover.
Yeah.
I do recall that.
With the high laces.
With the buttons.
Buttons and high laces.
Yeah, laces and buttons and whatever it was. It was very pretty.
Beautiful. She had them made. Those shoes were custom made for both of us. The two older children got. And if the shoes got small later on, another child had them. So we had those high shoes up to about mid-ankle at least, you know, mid-calf at least. And they were with buttons and then laces all the way up. They were beautiful.
Yeah, I loved them. However, those, Shirley said they were made to order. They had to be. There was nothing sold that was ready-made. Mm-hmm. Dresses, shoes.
Everything had to be made.
To order.
Linens had to be made.
To
everything.
Order. Everything. There were no stores that sold these things like they do in this country. You have all kinds of competition.
You made it yourself, Mose?
Oh, Nat wants to. I had told him the story. That was
not
very important. Nice. It was. Why?
Is because you traveled to another town.
This was in
no,
Ireland?
No. It was in the same town. It's a story about we went to right. This was right before we came to this country where we had those lovely little dresses that were made by Fage.
Yeah.
You remember?
Yeah.
And there was a wedding. Leia got married. And
my aunt Esther's sister, younger sister, got married. So, of course, whoever lived in all the family was invited. Everybody, all the relatives were invited.
So my mother was invited to take two children, and we went. I guess you didn't have to get an invitation when someone got in the family got married. You just assumed that you would be there. And my mother took Shirley and me. We had the clothes going to America, so she must have felt very good about that. And when the klezmer, now we have klezmer here, now in this country. Klezmer music.
Klezmer music, you must have heard of that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
They had klezmer at that wedding playing music. And if you wanted a dance, you had to pay. So my mother paid for Shirley and me to dance. We had learned a very beautiful dance from my aunt Malke.
Yeah.
Several beautiful dances, and my mother wanted to show us off, I guess. And we went to this wedding, and we did this dance solo. So that's
just the two of us, the patch dance we did.
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
Patch?
Patch dance.
The one, too. Okay, so that's what the story that Nat wanted us to tell. I guess he enjoyed that one.
Okay. So... do you remember things about being in America that struck you as different when you first arrived? I know it was a tumultuous time, but that were different and that you had not been used to. Any things that struck you about this country?
Well, when we came and we finally were taken out of Ellis Island, and we explained to you how we got out, that a bond had to be put up. No one in the family had enough money to put up for the bond, so my uncle arranged with his boss, who was very kind and very understanding, and took a chance on us, and he put up the bond so that we would not be a public charge, and so we were able to come out. And as we explained to you before, the family was broken up and went to different places to live. The most amazing thing to me was, first of all, what the streets looked like, and we were taken into an elevated train. I think it was the
Third Avenue L,
and we never saw anything like it, and we got deathly sick on it because from the motion and the whole thing, she got sick and I got sick. We had to get out on the station because otherwise we would just throw up, you know, in the train. We couldn't take it. But really, actually, when we got here, we were in such a dither. We were so mixed up, we didn't know where we were. Mm-hmm. Everything was different. There wasn't anything that we were accustomed to at all. Everything was so big, and the streets and the trolleys and the elevated train. Everything was different to us. We could not possibly imagine anything like that.
I remember being struck very hard by the amount of food that I saw on the tables in wherever we were. I remember even going to where you were staying at the Blooms, and Cousin Bertha put out so much food. I had never seen so much food. Cheeses and rolls and bagels and whatnot. I said, my goodness, this is very wonderful food. Rich people must live here. And also about the lights. So much light in the streets. I was very impressed with the lights. I remember going that one time to Aunt Esther's house when Mom had left me with Esther. Where were we? She left me with Esther in Uncle Joe's house. She took Sylvia. Shirley was already at the Blooms. And she went to visit my uncle and my aunt, Uncle Schmilke and Aunt Esther to the Lower East Side while we were still staying in the Bronx. And so I said to Esther, come on, I think I know how to get there. Mama went, but she didn't take us, but I think we'll go anyway. And I took my sister Esther, who was younger than I, and I said, we'll go see what's over there. And she said, okay. So I took her. But at that time, you had to have a ticket to go into the elevated. You had to have money to pay, buy the ticket, and go through. Children, I think, were free. But you had to have an adult. And there were no adults. My mother had gone. So I waited for some adults to come along. And I said, when I saw some adults going, I said, this is the time, let's go. And we went right through, and I saw the man standing at the other side, the turnstile, and he was smiling. I wonder if he knew what was going on. He was smiling. And when I got off that, at Canal Street, I got off that train, that elevated, I was impressed with the lights. There were so many lights. It wasn't the daytime, but lots of lights were still on. And when we must have gone home, I was very impressed with the lights. The lights struck me as being so different. And the streets, of course, so crowded. We hadn't seen so many people. And while we lived in Ostrov, we had just a few people around most of the time. But here, the streets were teeming with children and adults. And it was to me, that was a lot of difference. The lights, the streets, and especially the food. The food was very impressive, by Bertha.
Yeah.
Very impressive. She had lots of food.
Well, they were well-to-do people, really. You know, he was a manufacturer.
I didn't see this kind of food even at Becky's.
And I stayed with them. And I remember one time he took me and his daughter, May, to the Capitol Theater. And that really... I was like mesmerized when I got in there. The beauty of the place, it was like a palace. I know that you probably were never in there, but had you ever been in Radio City? Well, this was more beautiful. The Capitol Theater was much more beautiful. It was very elegant and very, with the portieres of velvets and lights and chandeliers and mirrors. I think I walked into one of the mirrors because I did. He took the two of us on a Sunday afternoon to the Capitol, the movie and whatever else. I don't remember what the movie was about. I'm sure I didn't understand it because it was in English. But he took in his car, in his automobile, he took us downtown, from the Bronx to the Capitol Theater on 51st Street. It was very beautiful, very impressive. Yeah.
But they were rich, because I can only gauge that by the amount of food that was on the table. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of food, and wonderful food, delicious.
Was it your uncle, your Aunt Esther's husband, whose boss put up
yes.
the bond?
Yes, yes, yes. This man that I lived with was my father's cousin, this Morris and Bertha Bloom. Mm-hmm. They had two children. They had a daughter, May, and a young child, Teddy. They were young people.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any instances about learning English? Any particular experiences in the process of learning English?
I don't remember the process of learning, but all of a sudden I was able to speak. And I didn't seem to have any problem with it at all. In fact, it came so quickly and so suddenly that the principal of PS1, she wanted to speak to me and see me. What happened? And she couldn't believe that I was an immigrant of such short time.
How long, just roughly, do you have any idea how long it was before?
Well, it might have been maybe before I graduated. I was 2 years in that school, PS1. And then I graduated. So it may have been maybe close to my graduation. I don't remember. But she was so impressed and she couldn't imagine how quickly I learned to speak. She says, she told me, I think her name was Miss
Wilson.
And she said, I can't believe that you're here in this country so short time. And that's when that Miss Williams... She wanted to talk to Ms. Williams why I was getting bad marks in her class. But that Ms. Williams, she was a real anti-Semite. She was a real witch. First of all, she was a woman with gray hair, tall and heavy. And she never should have been a teacher because it was a very mixed neighborhood that we lived in. That PS1 was in a neighborhood where there were Italians, Jewish, Greeks, Chinese. All nationalities lived in that neighborhood. In the building that we lived, our next door neighbor was Chinese. The ones across the hall were Greeks. Mm-hmm. And we had Jewish people. And in the school, my class at that time had 7 Jewish girls, and the rest of them were of mixed background, mostly Italian.
This is in Henry Street?
On Henry Street, 37 Henry Street. And I was really very bright. And I knew my work. I had caught on to the arithmetic, and I was an outstanding student, and in every subject, really. And this teacher, Ms. Williams, called on me one time, and I knew she didn't like me, so whenever she called on me, I got very nervous. And she asked me to describe the Hudson River, you know, the boundaries, and how it flowed east or west or whatever. Well, I got up, and I got very nervous, and I started to describe the Mississippi River instead. So she said to me, "Sit down, Lieberman. I wish you were there."
That's the difference.
Those are the things we had to live through.
And that's the difference between my teachers, whom I remember with a great deal of affection, that first one who was called Miss Reese, and the second one who was called Mrs. Dunkel. And she was a doll. This was on the 3B. I was already 6 months in this country when I had Mrs. Dunkel. She was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And I think everybody felt this way about her. She was a good woman, a wonderful woman, and loving to all the children. In our class, there were just 4 Jewish girls, and the rest, about 28, were of a different origin or ethnic group. And there are good teachers. I just don't want Shirley to give the impression that all of them were bad.
In that same school, I had Miss Adler, who was wonderful.
That's true.
And other teachers who were great, but this woman never should have been a teacher because she certainly didn't know how to deal with children, especially a foreigner, an immigrant, who was doing so well. And the principal was so proud of me, and she treated me this way. It was very painful to me.
Learning English for me was probably different. First of all, when I was at Miss Reese's class, I was told to go down to the yard, and there was another teacher there, and they had cards that she held up cards. I don't know what they said on the cards, but I was supposed to learn from that, I think. I don't know. And I went to that area in the school, the PS40, maybe for a couple of weeks, but I don't know what it was supposed to be for. But we learned as time went by, reading, and it didn't seem to be as hard as it is for older people. I think children adapt much, much quicker, learn much faster, and it was not hard at all. I think when we moved to Henry Street, by that time we were here 3 months, I was able to speak pretty well. Yes, and I think you were too.
Yeah.
Now, in your school then, were a lot of the children immigrant children?
No.
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 None?
They were of different ethnicities, but they were had been born here.
It was a mixed neighborhood, but everybody got along fine. Everybody was lovely. We had no problem with other religions. Not at all. I remember the girls in my class, they were a lot older than I was. They were girls who were young women, but they were very troublesome to the teachers, especially one I remember was very bad, and she gave the teacher a lot of trouble. She was unruly. So the teacher made her president of the class, and after that she was fine, and she graduated. They finally got rid of her.
No, the teachers were very nice at PS1. It's the oldest school in the city.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if it's still in existence.
I think it still is.
Yeah.
It still is, right. They may have made some changes. But
it's on Henry Street.
This was we lived in Henry Street for my first Christmas. That's what is the first Christmas. By that time, we were here 9 months. No, even more than that, close to a year. But I was still with Mrs. Dunkel. And I remember that the children, they were going to have a Christmas tree, and I had not known what that was. And the children brought in these toys for the Christmas tree that broke very easily.
No, the decorations.
What do they call those?
Ornaments.
The
Christmas
ornaments?
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by that. I was fascinated by what are those things. I never saw them before. And eventually, I guess I must have understood that this was for the Christmas tree. And Mrs. Dunkel gave us presents for Christmas. Each child got a table in a little box. It was a table and chairs, 4 chairs wooden chairs and a wooden table and a little box. They all fitted under, and it was such a nice thing for her to have done. And she received gifts too, I guess, but I didn't bring any. I didn't know about that. So that was it.
Okay, so how about socializing? Like your parents, did they join social clubs, or how did they simply, like your mother, was she simply with the other family, the cousins and your aunt and all that, or were there like social clubs that the adults belonged to?
Well, there was a club at the Madison House. It was called the Mother's Club, and it was run by a Mrs. Dorf, or something like that. I don't think that was Dorf, but anyhow, that was the only club that my mother belonged to. The socializing was done with the family, my uncle Schmilke and his wife Esther, and that was all the socializing. There were others, and then there were some other people who had come to this country from Europe, and they too had some sort of getting together occasionally, let's say on a Saturday night or a Sunday afternoon, but mostly it was just the two families.
Right. But once in a while, they used to have like a big ball, but from Rostova ball. All the people that came from our town used to organize like a dance, you know, and so my mother would go and would take me and her, the two older children. I don't know what she did with the younger ones.
Would there be a lot of people from
Ostrava? Oh, yes, there were a lot of people there from Ostrava. I didn't know
them.
Well,
we were grown by then, I think.
Yeah, we were more grown. Yeah. But I didn't know them. It was my mother who knew all these landslides, you know, and she used to take us. But most of her social life was with the family. It was, I don't remember... some landslide used to come
Yankel Green used to come.
And his wife.
Yes, and they would come mostly to Aunt Esther's house.
Yeah.
And that was a social activity. But also she used to go to the Jewish theater.
Right.
She loved the Jewish theater.
I went with her.
And I went to the Jewish theater a few times myself. And my mother used to tell us about Jenny Goldstein, who was an actress then. And some
wheelchair
of the
jerkers.
Yes,
the
right.
Would they be about Europe? Would they be about the old country?
No, they were
no?
dramatic stories, you know. But wheelchair jerkers, really, when you had to cry, otherwise you didn't enjoy the show.
Yeah, I think so. I think you really had a good time, and if you were able to have a drama like that to make you feel very bad.
Now, how did your mother feel about coming here?
Well, her husband sent for her, so she was ready to go. He had been away for 7 years during the time of the war, and until things got settled, we had no communication with him during the war, no mail, nothing. So really, he was far removed from her too. 7 years, a long time for separation. So when she came, she was ready to go, and she made all the arrangements to go when we got here. But I think, first of all, my mother was 34 when we came to this country, wasn't she? She already had 4 children. And my father probably was the same age, and he was here alone for 7 years, a young man. So if he had some affairs here, I don't blame him. He had to have some sort of release.
But I do blame him for lack of responsibility when we did
too. I mean, he knew, he sent for a family. He should have been ready to accept us and make a home for us. What he did before we came, I don't want to know, and I forgive him. But he should have made a home for us when we came.
No, he wasn't nice at all. He was very unnice. I recall the trip to the hospital the first time, but he was still there, and where my mother was staying with my father's cousins, their name was also Bloom, but Blum, it was a different Bloom. And they took my mother and me, and perhaps you, I think you were there too, to visit my father, who was still in the hospital. And this was the first time that my father saw us after these many years of separation. And I can still remember when he walked toward us, we were walking toward him. He was already ambulatory. And what he said, "I'll be right back." He did not embrace my mother. He did not embrace me. And he surely did not embrace you, because he walked right out. And I thought, this is later, of course. At that time, I didn't really remember him. I did not know who he was even, I didn't really care. But later, when you think about it, in retrospect, my God, how do you do such a thing? You haven't seen your wife for so long, and so, she went through so much during the war. You haven't seen your children for so long. What kind of a father, what kind of a husband are you? This is how I thought later. And I think I still feel this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, how about your mother? After it was clear that she wasn't going to be reunited with your father, was she happy in this country? Did she adapt, adjust? Did she?
Well, she made the best of a very terrible situation. We all try to help. My uncles and try to patch things up, but they were not doing it right, doing it properly. They
were not diplomatic.
They didn't know.
They were not psychologists.
They didn't know how to behave in such a. They sent me as the oldest child to talk to my father to come, to join the family. I could not speak to him. First of all, I didn't remember him. I was a young child when he left. I was only 13 when I came, and I could not. Every time I tried to talk, I got hysterical. They put me through this terrible ordeal all the time. I don't know, it was such a traumatic thing for me. To ask me to talk to my father, he should come back to us. I could not speak to him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, my mother was also terrible. She didn't know what to do. What is she going to do? Here she is in a strange country with four children. It's a terrible time. She wasn't prepared to make a living or anything.
Did she work at some point, your mother?
She couldn't work. She had four children. Like I explained to you, we took home work.
Yeah.
So we all worked on it. Mm-hmm. Children, everybody.
Yeah, she took home lots of things from factories that were given out to be done at home. It paid much less than they paid very little to the people who were in the factories. But you can imagine how much they paid the people who were out of the factories.
Yeah, this was the time of the sweatshops.
Right. And Shirley was talking about my father and how she had to plead with him to come back to us and make a home for us. And I remember that he was judged to support us. The amount I subsequently read in the decree was $6 a week, a child.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it was a month. It was not a week. In those days, $6 a week would have been a lot of money, $24 a week. I don't know. Perhaps it was. But anyhow, he was negligent about sending it. Maybe he didn't even know how to send it. Maybe he didn't even have a checking account at that time. Or maybe whatever.
I'm sure he didn't have a checking account. Where was he going to get money to put in a checking
account? Right. Well, he was making a living. But
I didn't know from things like
so that. My mother chose me to go collect the whatever he can offer, and he lived as a boarder in an apartment where he had just one bedroom, I presume, and there was a woman there who was the owner of the apartment, the lessee, I guess. Anyhow, I would go and have to wait for him. I sometimes stayed outside. And if the weather was bad, the woman who lived in the apartment, whose landlady she was to him, she would tell me to invite me to come in to sit and wait for him inside the house. And I did that on occasion. When he would finally arrive after me sitting there for so long, he would take the money out of his pocket, hand it to me without a word, and I couldn't wait to leave. And this is how you asked whether my mother worked. We used to get some money from him, and my mother maybe got some help from her brothers, Joe would come over with some food occasionally. He had a delicatessen store, and he would bring some canned foods, and whatever my father gave me is the way we were able to manage. Mm-hmm. It was not the best way, but that was the way it was. And my impression of that time was simply awful. My father was not a father as a human being should have been.
Mm-hmm. Was your mother's spirit? Your mother sounded so spunky in the ways that she managed in Poland. Did that carry over to the United States, or do you think because of the language barrier and all that had happened that it was? That she changed somehow?
No, she didn't. She tried in every which way, like mm-hmm. I told you.
Well,
she,
how about the candy store?
Yeah. After we lived on the east side. Yeah,
and we were living in Henry Street when she got in touch with Gussie.
Yeah.
And they both went into business. And
we had a candy store. They,
in the Bronx again.
Oh. Yeah.
On Brook Avenue.
Right.
Now I think it's probably a very depressed neighborhood, but in those days it was not. And they had this candy store, and that's how she tried. It didn't work very well. The candy store was not a good, was a flop. It didn't make any money. So that's when we came back to the Lower East Side at Madison Street, at 212 Madison Street, next door to my aunt and uncle. But she worked at the Madison House. At the Madison House, there were things that could be done. They served lunches at times. My mother helped out with that. And they served box lunches when we would go on picnics or outings. And she would help do that. So she made a few dollars that way. And again, there was homework. We took the work into the house, and we all helped. There were ties that we used to work on. There were even pants.
Belts we made.
Oh, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So this was the way it was. And of course, as we grew older, we went to work. And I went to work and made $6 part-time when I was going to school. After school, I made $6 a week. I worked for Miss Kerr. She was an accountant. And that was on Broadway. And I contributed the $6. I walked all the way from Broadway to 212 Madison Street. I walked to save the nickel car fare. That's what it was, because we needed the nickel. And that's what I did. And in the summertime, I worked in a factory where they made greeting cards.
And how old would you have been then?
I must have been about 14 by that time.
Well, I worked part-time when I went to high school. I made $2 a week from 8 to 12. Then I'd run home, quickly have my lunch and run to, and I had a late pass for school, so I could come in, let's say, about 1:45. They allowed me to come in. I made $2 a week. Filling tea bags, and of course summers I always worked. And then when I was 16, I had a full-time job from 9 to 5.
Wow. Well, before we close, because we're practically at the end of this tape, maybe each of you could say what effect all of what we've been talking about had on you for the rest of your life, once that you married and were adults, that your early life, how do you think that changed you, or what impression on you do you think your early life in Poland and also in the United States had on you later?
Well, naturally, our experiences early in our life had a great effect on us. But I don't think it harmed us, because we grew to love and to be loved. And I had a lot of experience at the Madison House with young people of my age, boys, girls. We learned to dance, and we forgot the trials and tribulations of the earlier years, because it was fun. I enjoyed it very much. We had so many things to do at the Madison House. We used to go on outings in the summertime, and in the spring we have races, and Madeline and I won the three-legged race and we got medals. And life was wonderful in those days, though. We lived on the Lower East Side without a bathroom, without a toilet, without all those things, but it didn't matter. And again, I say this, my father I don't think that it made much difference at all in our lives, simply because we did not know any better. We had no experience with a father, so we did not miss that. And it did not affect our lives as far as our husbands were concerned or our sex life was concerned. We were able to function as very well as human beings. And as I said before, we learned to be in love, and we learned to love, and they'd be loved, and it was really not bad at all.
Good. All right, I'll...
I'll
make it very short. The fact that we didn't have a father all our lives made no difference in our life. We didn't miss him. My mother and our family gave us enough love to last us a lifetime. We had a loving family. We had lots of love all around us. So it didn't really injure us at all that my father was so mean to us. We didn't need him.
Well, we're going to close here. I want to thank you so much. This is Janet Levine. I've been speaking with Shirley Ruffman and Lillian Levine, and I'm signing off. Just two full tapes.
Yeah. Ready? I just want to say, Janet, it was such a pleasure to meet you, and it was so wonderful to have you, and you went out of your way, and you spent so much time. We appreciate it. You were wonderful with us at Ellis Island. You're lovely here, and we really, really got to know and like you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.